Okay, good morning. We're going to go ahead and take roll call here before we call the meeting to order so we know who we've got on the telephone line. Just as an introductory note, we do have lots of people who want to call in today for dockets. And so when your item is done, we'd ask that you drop off the line so you can free up some space for some folks who need to get on. Obviously, you can always listen on the internet as well, so which we have live at this time. So again, do a quick roll call. We have Don Glover,
yes.
City of Elk Point. Great. Dave Ross?
Yes.
Thomas Yon?
Yes.
Yon or Yon?
Yon.
Yon, okay. Thanks. Kenna Hagen?
Kenna Hagen, yes.
Kenna, thanks. Susan Stewart? Okay. Dane Stevens? Dane Stevens, Mid-American? Okay. Tom Basso and Mike Coddington?
Tom Basso, yes.
Okay, good morning. Brad Klein?
Morning, I'm here.
Good morning, Brad. Tammy Aberle?
Good morning, Chairman, I'm here.
Good morning. Bob Towers? Okay. Basil Copeland? Scott Besmer or LaDonna Emmonth or Ron Bloom?
This is Ron Bloom.
Okay, great. Roger Lorenzen?
Yes, here.
Good morning.
Morning.
Robert Jared?
Yes, sir.
Good morning. Adam Solomon?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Kathy Ford?
Yes, sir.
Great. Anybody on the telephone line that I'm missing? Okay, well, with that, let's go ahead and call this meeting to order. This is a meeting of the South Dakota Public Utilities Commission. It's Tuesday, December 18th, 2007, a little bit after 8:30 in the morning. We're here at the State Capitol Building, Room 412. We have a number of people here in Pierre as well as on the telephone line. I'm Commissioner Dusty Johnson. Joining me at this meeting are Commissioners Gary Hansen and Steve Kolbeck. Ken, we'll remind everyone once you're done with your item, if you could please drop off the telephone line, that would be appreciated. Our first item, and I should note we have both an agenda and an addendum to today's agenda, and from time to time we'll be bouncing back and forth. Our intention is to take items regarding reduced rates long distance and Northwestern Energy's rate case toward the end of the agenda. And with that, we'll dive into item number one, which is consumer reports, and that's a status report on inquiries and complaints. Ms. Gregg.
Thank you, Commissioner Johnson. The Commission has received a total of 151 contacts since the last report was prepared for the November 20th, 2007 Commission meeting. 22 of the contacts involved telecommunication services, 31 of the contacts involved electrical services, 9 contacts involved natural gas services, 1 contact involved both electrical and natural gas service, 20 contacts involved cell phone services, 37 contacts related to the Do Not Call Registry, and 31 contacts were related to issues not regulated by the PUC. 2,101 of the 2,264 complaints received in 2007 have been resolved, and 2,355 of the 2,466 complaints received in 2006 have been resolved.
Thanks very much, Ms. Gregg. Any questions, Ms. Gregg? We need to take up an administrative item at this time. We apparently have some folks who are trying to get on the telephone line but can't. I was curious, Mr. Solomon, Ms. Ford, I think your items don't come up until maybe later in the agenda. Could we ask you to listen on the internet and join on here in a few minutes once we've taken a few items?
Sure. This is Adam Solomon. That would be fine.
Okay.
How do I gain access to that on the internet?
If you go to www.puc.sd.gov, at the very top of the page, you'll find a live link to a streaming audio.
Okay. I will do that, and then if you could just ensure that I'm back on before the reduced rate matter starts, I'd appreciate that.
Absolutely, and since you're doing us a favor, if for some reason you can't hear on the internet, or we'll verify that you're on certainly before we take up that item. Thank you.
Okay, I know Ms. Meredith Moore is there, and if I'm not on, she can call me in my office, and I'll jump on back to the conference bridge.
I've made a visual ID, so we know that she's here. Sounds
okay.
Good.
Thank you.
Yep.
Bye.
Bye.
All right, with that, we've restored balance in the phone line system and can proceed. Our first electricity item deals with tariff revisions and our interconnection guidelines. They are related to item number one on the addendum, and I don't know what Mr. Solms or Ms. Semler's what they prefer to do. So perhaps we'll take up those grouping of dockets and they can address them initially, at least as they see fit.
Mr. Chairman, this is Nathan Solem with staff. Staff has conducted a high-level review of the interconnection filings and has found the following key issues that might warrant further discussion in the commission-ordered workshop development of a statewide best practices model. And those issues are liability insurance provisions, tiered frameworks, including a fast track for review of different classes of distributed generators, the extent of utility-specific technical requirements versus adoption of IEEE 1547 and the UL 1741 standards, a wide variance in the technical interconnection guidelines, and a wide variance in the procedures, and also the volume of documents in some of the filings for the distributed generators to review. Staff, therefore, recommends approval of these filings on an interim basis only, perhaps until the workshop and rulemaking process yields draft best practice rules for this commission's consideration.
At this time, it's probably appropriate to look to all of the public utilities that have made those tariff revisions or just something more than informational filings, but filings of their manuals or requirements to see if they have any comments they'd like to make at this time. I would just note for those listening on the Internet, we did have all six public utilities providing electric service did make the filings. At this time, unless anybody else has any comments, we'll open it up to questions or comments. Mr. Solem, why, as I looked over the filings, there did seem to be a lot of differences among them, a large number of differences, and at least in my mind, it seemed as though some of the filings weren't as complete as I would like them, as I would have liked them. Can you give us a little more insight into why you're recommending approval? And I understand that's just on an interim basis, but why you're recommending approval?
Well, because the commission ordered the development of a best practices rule in the workshop setting, staff just felt that those issues, those differences could best be resolved in a workshop setting, then we'd go forward with that best practices rule. And in the interim, since the filings are there for distributed generators to look at, they'd be there available for them to use.
I should look at thanks very much, Mr. Trollum. Mr. Bassel, Mr. Klein, do you have any comments? I don't know if you've had an opportunity to look at the filings, but I know you've taken an interest in this issue in the past.
Thanks, Commissioner Johnson. This is Ed Klein at ELPC. I guess I don't have anything more specific to add other than Mr. Solem's high-level overview. I think he hit some of the important points, and, you know, I'd be looking forward to providing any resources that ELPC can in the upcoming workshop process.
Thanks very much, Mr. Klein.
This is Tom Basso. You know, basically, it's nice to have something in the interim, and using the existing standards or interconnection rules that the utilities have, at least that's a baseline to work today until you get the workshops underway and come to a state rule. So that's a good approach.
Okay, thanks very much. You know, and I guess I'll just, well, we'll see if there are any other questions.
Yes, Nathan.
Stewart from Mid-American Energy. I guess, is this the opportunity for utilities to speak?
Yes, absolutely. Go ahead, Ms. Stewart.
In response to your question about the diversity of the, I guess I want to make sure that you realize that Mid-American's procedures are based on the FERC small generator interconnection procedures, and they're not, I don't know how ours compare to the other utilities, but I want to make it clear that ours are founded on the FERC standards, and they're not just something that we, and they appear to be fully satisfactory to FERC, you know, even if that may not be what the commission ends up with through this process that they're going to start today.
Well, thanks very much for that, Ms. Stewart. And Commissioner Kolbeck's got a question, but after he asks it, I may have some follow-up on your comments. Thanks.
Yes, I was wondering if the workshop setting is inhibited by us not taking action today? Or would the workshops continue to get maybe a firm resolution to this? Or does the commission have to take action today to make the workshops flow?
I believe the workshops could continue. They were ordered by the commission in the May order, so I think they need to proceed, yeah.
I just have questions in my mind that I'm not quite settled with, and I just want to make sure that the process can continue one way or another. So, thank you.
Other questions? For discussion's sake, I'm going to move the commission to take no action at this time. My rationale would be, you know, I've got some probably more than mild but not quite, you know, significant concerns with some of the filings. I think the dispute resolution is a concern in a number of the filings. I think some of the technical requirements, I think, are well, I've got some problems with some of the way that they're worded. I think some of the filings are, frankly, really confusing, even to people who have a passing knowledge of distributed interconnection. I feel like even on an interim basis, approving these sends a message that maybe, at least from my perspective, that I find them more acceptable than I really do. And so I think it's a great first step because now we're able to see what we've got out there. To be honest, this has made me believe even more than I did prior to seeing them that not only do we need to drive toward best practices, but we really do need greater uniformity and greater standardization over this process and the requirements. And I know that everyone's service territory is a little different, but I think when you start talking about wanting to protect your system and wanting to protect people and wanting to protect equipment, I just think that there can be lots and lots. This process can be much easier and much more standardized than it is right now. And other states have had success doing that. And I think it would be a benefit for, you know, distributed interconnection if we move toward that. So that's not part of a motion. That's just sort of editorial comment to Mr. Solem and the rest of the staff and all the participants that, to me, I'm not even sure the best practices go far enough. And I haven't made up my mind completely on that. It's just sort of my thoughts and opinions to help guide you as you move forward. Other comments on the motion?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Solem, could you give us an idea of how an interim process would work here? If we're approving this on an interim basis, what do you anticipate? The duration of the interim, what would be accomplished during that interim?
Certainly, Commissioner. Staff is tentatively scheduling a workshop that would be proposing that it be handled by three professional facilitators. That first workshop is tentatively scheduled for February 13th and 14th. We're figuring it would take probably four workshops, two in person here in workshop in peer and two teleconference workshops, probably over the next 9 months to a year, at which time we would hopefully have draft rules through the rulemaking process for your consideration.
Thank you. And would, if I may follow up, Mr. Chairman, would there be would the purpose of these workshops be to create a somewhat standardized process for all of the an homogenized, standardized system for us?
The purpose, as in the order, as I understand it, is to develop a best practices rule. Staff's plan was to start with the Oregon rules and work from them, which reflects some of the most current best practices that have been developed nationwide, and then we would adjust those to fit the needs of South Dakota.
I appreciate the concerns that Chairman Johnson has, and I have the same concerns that we arrive at that. It would make it a lot less confusing and less challenging, at least for me. I suspect for some others as well. I want to get there. Would there be a challenge of setting these aside for that duration and waiting for that process to culminate culminate? Are there any challenges that you know or council knows of?
None that I can think of.
Okay. So if we, with the motion that we are apparently discussing at the present time, you don't see any challenges, we'd still be able to go through the entire process, arrive at the standardized procedure without creating any difficulties.
I don't see it interfering with the workshop process itself.
Okay,
no.
Great. Thank you.
Yeah, maybe before the commission would take action, we'll look to Ms. Weiss to see if she has any additional comments.
Well, I would agree that I think that the commission should just defer any action on these today. I understand, you know, approving on an interim basis. I just don't think going through them that necessarily the commission wants for this even a stamp of approval as interim processes. And I also think that since they are out there now, we still have that function that people can go out there and look to see what, you know, the companies are applying right now, even without saying that they have interim approval.
Other comments on the pending motion? And certainly if any of the affected parties want to make a comment, I think that'd be appropriate at this time, too. All right, hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Colbeck.
Aye.
Hansen.
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0, and action on that item is deferred. Mr. Solem, did you want to take up EL06-018 at this time?
I think that would be appropriate, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, well, then let's go ahead and do that.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Hi, this is Andy Winborn with Union County Electric. I did get on the conference call here recently for docket number 34, just to announce that I am online.
Oh, thank you very much. I appreciate that. The question in EL06-018 is, shall the commission authorize the executive director to hire a consultant and enter into contracts with the consultant? Mr. Solem, Ms. Sumler.
Mr. Chairman, this is Nathan Solem with staff. Staff is recommending a workshop format for this distributed generation best practice rule development that would be facilitated by three skilled professionals. The use of skilled facilitators is recommended in order to resolve the issues in as time-effective manner as possible, to provide a knowledge base from experiences in other states to solve problems, and be able to very well answer questions about both technical requirements and procedural issues. This format was used very successfully by Oregon and is currently being used by Florida. From comments received, it appears that states that have not proceeded with skilled facilitators may have taken longer than optimum to complete the workshop process. Two of the three proposed facilitators, Mr. Tom Basso or Mr. Mike Connington from NREL and Mr. Brad Klein of the Environmental Law and Policy Center, are self-funded, while the third necessitates a contract to cover consulting time and expenses. This facilitator is Wayne Shirley from the Regulatory Assistance Project. RAP assists states in the electric utility regulatory process, and Mr. Shirley, a former New Mexico commissioner, fulfilled the same role we are proposing during the Oregon workshops. Two of Mr. Shirley's expertises are interconnection procedures and processes and facilitating the negotiating process on issues. One-third of his expenses would be covered by technical assistance funds we have received from the EPA Clean Energy Office, with staff requesting approval for the executive director to enter into a contract for the remaining expenses of $17,500. This covers two in-person two-day workshops and two teleconferencing workshops and a total of 23 consulting days. If you desire, I have copies of RAP's proposals for your review.
Thanks very much. We'll see if any of the parties affected by this workshop process have any comments. Hearing none, any questions?
Yes, Mr. Solem, this is a consultant that we would hire outside of our office, correct?
That is correct.
And you would be the lead on this? You would be I would be the staff representative on these dockets, on this docket at the workshop. So
okay. You'll be his point of contact.
Yes, I would.
Okay. And you would, you have no problem with Mr. Shirley? You think he's very well capable, I assume?
I've discussed what he did at Oregon with the staff at the Oregon Public Utilities Commission and feel that this approach would be the most efficient way for us to get through this process.
Okay. Thank you.
I'm just relieved to know that there's life after regulation. Any other questions? Hearing none, does anyone have a motion?
A motion EL06018 that the commission authorize the executive director to hire a consultant and enter contracts with the consultants.
Motion has been made. No second is required. Is there any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Colbeck.
Aye.
Hanson.
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. Thanks, Mr. Solomon. Ms. Sumler. And with that, we'll head back to the main agenda. And electric item number 2 is EL07-034. This deals with filing by the City of Elk Point for approval of its revised service territory as a result of annexation. And the question for the commission today is simply, shall it approve that revised service territory? At this point, we would look toward the City of Elk Point for any comments they would have.
Yes, this is Don Glover, City Administrator in Elk Point. Come ago, a convenience center truck stop had petitioned the city to be annexed into the territory. So at that time, we also asked them if they would be interested in being provided by municipal electricity, and they were. So we worked with a local co-op here, and we have gone through that process.
Okay, and Union County Electric, any comments?
Yeah, this is Andy Winborn.
Yeah, go ahead.
Union County Electric. Yeah, I think Don and I worked this out, and we followed all the laws, and we're in compliance with all of it. We've provided the temporary service for it, and as soon as you approve it, we're ready to turn over that service territory to the City of Oak Point.
Great. Thanks, Andy. At this time, we'd see if there are any, well, we'll look to staff to see staff comments. Mr. Jacobson, Ms. Kramer.
Thank you, Chairman. Nothing really to add to that. It's just the extension of service following the annexation by the city. There were a couple questions staff did ask, and that was put into the docket yesterday late. I wasn't quite sure whether to do that or not, but I didn't know if it would be relevant or help you, but it was put in yesterday. But no problems. It followed all the statutes and rules, and we'd recommend approval.
Thanks, Mr. Jacobson. Questions for any of the parties?
Just one question I have. Is this bare ground, or is there existing industry out there? Or what
at the time, it was bare ground.
It is bare ground annexation?
Yeah.
At the present time, it was, yes.
Thank you.
Further questions? Hearing none, does anyone have a motion?
Move that the commission approve the revised service territory as a result of annexation for EL07-034.
Motion has been made. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Colbeck.
Aye.
Hanson.
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. Thanks very much to everyone.
Thank you for your time.
We'll now call up gas and electric number 1, which is docket GE06-001. This deals with the merger between Northwestern Corporation and BBI Glacier Corporation, which is a subsidiary of Babcock & Brown Infrastructure Limited. And the question for the commission is, shall it authorize the termination of the settlement agreement between the commission and Northwestern and BBI that was in a FERC docket, and authorize the executive director and general counsel to execute any necessary documents memorializing that termination? We have Mr. Gertis representing Northwestern at the mic, and we will let you take it away.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the commission. My name is Dave Gertis. I'm a local lawyer, and I represent Northwestern Corporation and did represent Northwestern Corporation as it related to the proposed merger that this commission had on its docket in the year indicated, that starting in 2006. As the commission will remember, the commission voted to approve the commission voted and decided to conclude that it had no jurisdiction to either approve or deny the proposed merger after a rather thorough and extensive review of both the facts and the law associated with the merger. The commission and Northwestern were also involved in a FERC process to approve the merger. As a part of the FERC process, the commission and Northwestern entered into a settlement agreement, which is on file with the commission and is on file in this docket. As the commission knows, the Montana commission refused to approve the merger. Attached as Exhibit A to the petition, the petition we now have in front of us, is the letter of BBI, which, after an attempt to satisfy the Montana Commission by a revised proposal, was rejected by the Montana Commission. BBI concluded that it could not go forward with the merger and terminated the merger as permitted in the merger agreement. Going back to the settlement agreement that the parties had between them that was entered into in the FERC proceeding, if you look at paragraph 19 of that agreement, it provides for such an eventuality, and it says, and I'm going to leave out some of the words, but it says, after the effective date of this agreement, in the event of a material change in circumstances, any applicant may petition the South Dakota Public Utilities Commission for termination of this agreement. That's what this petition is, and certainly the fact that the merger did not go forward and the fact that the settlement agreement was dependent upon the merger, we would submit as a material change in circumstances. And the agreement itself contemplates that this may very well have happened, and it did happen, and so we're simply wanting to wipe the slate clean. Northwestern is seeking to wipe the slate clean, and therefore just asking that the commission enter an order recognizing the obvious, and that is that there is no longer any reason for the settlement agreement, and that the settlement agreement, the merger that brought about the settlement agreement did not go forward, and therefore the settlement agreement should be terminated. And therefore, in our petition, we are asking the commission to terminate the settlement agreement. That's what it amounts to. Mr. Smith was serving as staff associated with this, and I'm sure he probably has some comments too.
Mr. Smith, your comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I basically agree with, I think, everything that Mr. Gerdes said. In addition to the fact that the event that this agreement was premised on has ceased to exist or will not happen, and that's the BBI merger. To me, a couple of things, I guess, arguing in favor of termination are that I think it was the last session, Senate Bill 25, in response to the jurisdictional issues that came up in this case, the commission sponsored legislation to take, to give itself a more robust authority in terms of transaction approval. And one of the things I guess that I see by not terminating the agreement is it leaves this sort of vestige hanging out there that whose status we're going to be unsure of, you know, the extent to which is it effective, is it not. And to me, it's litigation and problems waiting to happen. It's clear to me that the underlying premises for the contract, for the agreement, were the existence of that merger. It's a settlement agreement, not in a PUC proceeding, but in a FERC proceeding. And one note on that, and Mr. Gerdes and I have had some conversations
about this. I added in, if you'll note, a second part of the question, or if you want to call it that, shall you authorize either or both of the executive director and or me, ex officio anyway, to execute a termination document. Mr. Gerdes has requested the entry of an order, and I don't necessarily have a problem with that. The reason I put in that second provision, however, that's what you did in the original authorization, in the original action you took relative to the FERC proceeding, is you authorized us as your representatives in an executive capacity to do this in a proceeding of another agency, a federal agency. My concern in this, and the reason I put that in, is sort of just a safety valve, I guess, is having concluded we have no jurisdiction over that transaction, I have a little bit of concern about whether the entry of an order is really legally effective, and that whether we might not want to have just a very brief termination agreement that we execute that would be really in the other forum, which is the FERC forum, if that makes any sense. And that's why I put that in there, just to make it clear that if it comes to pass we don't have authority to issue an order in this proceeding, we still take an executive action to do it in the FERC proceeding.
Thanks, Mr. Smith. questions? And I would have one for Mr. Gerdes. I mean, I'm reviewing the docket here, and it appears as though the commission didn't enter into this agreement via the use of an order. Why do you, I mean, is the second question that Mr. Smith proposed, is that acceptable to Northwestern?
Mr. Chairman, I have a smile on my face because there's the old saying, you put two lawyers in a room and it's hard to get them to agree. I think probably either solution works, but the reason I say we need an order is because that's what the agreement says. The agreement says, in the event of a material change, any applicant may petition the PUC for termination of the agreement. Well, that's just what we've done. Now, my legal procedure 101 is when I petition for something, I'm asking the commission to do something or not do something. And typically the commission acts by order. I'm sure that if the commission ordered that Mr. Smith and the executive secretary sign a document terminating the agreement, I'm sure that would be fine. So whichever way the commission chooses to do it, just so long as we make it clear that the outstanding settlement agreement is terminated, I don't have a particular preference.
Mr. Chairman, just on that note, I don't have any objection to the entry of an order. I just think there's some question about when this was a settlement in a FERC proceeding, whether our order may, at some point in the future, somebody might decide to say, hey, well, you had no authority to enter an order. So to me, it's not necessarily an either or. It's maybe, yeah, I don't mind if we do both. And maybe we don't even, if they don't want to have a termination agreement, fine. But you might want to have one.
We'll
just
take
in
it.
Case. Yeah.
Perhaps, Mr. Chairman, excuse me for interrupting, but perhaps you could give me an order and authorizing Mr. Smith, and he can have his termination agreement.
Did anybody else want anything while we're handing out goodies? Yeah, go ahead, Mr. Commissioner Hansen.
I was going to ask Mr. Smith exactly what he just stated, but I was going to preface it by remarking to Mr. Gerdes' statement that you get two attorneys in a room and they can't agree. I had always heard that any town that could not afford one attorney could easily support two.
Yeah. Commissioner Hansen, I've heard that many times myself.
Commissioner Kolbeck, did you have something?
I'm just wondering where the headquarters are going to be. Those are Montana.
You're no Brian Schweitzer, Commissioner Kolbeck. Any further questions? If anyone has a motion, certainly action is appropriate. And I will go ahead and move that the commission authorize the termination of the settlement agreement and authorize the executive director and general counsel to execute any necessary documents memorializing the termination. Motion's been made. Any discussion? And I'll just offer that, to me, I think a termination agreement would be, you know, fully appropriate in this instance. If we would have brought this into being with an order, I might feel differently, but I think this will take care of it. Any other comments?
Are we doing both or just one?
Just the termination. Just one.
Just the termination. I agree.
Okay. Any further discussion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Kolbeck?
Aye.
Hansen?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
With that, we'll proceed. We'll skip over natural gas item number one, as that's the rate case that we're moving toward the end, since that may take some time. And instead, we'll move to pipeline safety. Our first item is PS07-001. That deals with the filing by Montana Dakota Utilities Company, a division of MD Resources Group, for approval of a waiver. And today, shall the commission approve the waiver? We'll look first to see if anybody on MDU is online wishing to take this this item.
Yes, this is Ron Bloom.
Go ahead, Mr. Bloom.
I'm the senior region engineer for Montana Dakota Utilities in Black Hills region, located in Rapid City. MDU is requesting a waiver of the current rule requiring atmospheric corrosion surveys every 3 years in favor of a 4-year schedule. This waiver has been approved in our Minnesota, North Dakota, and Montana service territories. Based on studies done by others and our history and experience, MDU believes that granting this waiver will have no effect on pipeline integrity and the safety of our customers. We endorse the staff recommendation of the former South Dakota PUC pipeline safety manager, Martin Bettman, and agree to the conditions listed in it.
Thanks very much. Mr. Solem, is similar additional comments?
Staff recommends approval of the waiver request subject to the conditions stated in Mr. Bettman's recommendations, and if approved, forwarding of the order to PHMSA.
Questions?
Yeah, Mr. Solem, I guess I'm having trouble seeing the hardship. Could you maybe explain what the hardship was to ask for the waiver?
Perhaps the company could better address that, and then I can follow up.
Okay.
Sure. Currently, there's requirements for leak surveys once every 5 years, and we have those on a 4-year schedule. Moving the corrosion survey to a 4-year schedule allows us to conduct those with the same people that do the leak surveys, and that it's kind of a convenience. Probably a trade-off in cost, but it also, we believe, although the people that have been conducting the survey are operator qualified, this puts a little more experienced people in charge of that survey as well. And we're also moving towards automated meter reading, which eliminates some of the meter readers that have traditionally conducted the survey.
Thank you.
Sir, this is Gary Hansen. Could you give me an idea as to the cost that you incur for atmospheric corrosion inspection test?
Is Tammy Aberly on the line still?
Yes, I am.
Tammy, do you have anything as far as that goes?
No, I do not, Commissioner. We would need to get back to you with a response to that question.
Then
I have an additional question on the leak detection survey. Curious how much that costs as well. I'm going to assume you don't have that, do you?
I do not, sir.
Okay. When I looked at this request, and I was looking at the there have been a few challenges in South Dakota of recent, and I was just somewhat concerned from a standpoint that this would seem, at least to me, to have a more significant change than it looks on the surface. Perhaps you can help me with that, because as I look at having the atmospheric corrosion inspection test on a 3-year period and the leak detection survey on a 4-year, it would appear to me that you're having two different groups of people, and perhaps I'm wrong there, perhaps it's the same people, doing these tests, and it gives it a more thorough look from more eyes, and there's just a better chance of catching any challenges. Is that correct, or are there different eyes conducting both of these tests then, even when they're done the same time?
There have been different people looking at this on one test and another. What our request states is that, and what we've carried forward from these other cases, is that the employees that conduct the leak survey are traditionally OQ'd or operator qualified and in more areas than meter readers, and have a higher degree of expertise in noticing atmospheric corrosion, because it falls really quite in line with leak surveying. As far as more people seeing it, there are a variety of reasons that we're in the field every day looking at above ground facilities, and all the people are measurement technicians. Meter readers will still have that task to observe and look for atmospheric corrosion as well as other abnormal conditions. This really, the request is to put the formal surveys together and not really eliminate any of our other opportunities that we have for observing atmospheric corrosion.
Well, I appreciate the efficiencies that you're aiming for here. Is this going to provide a safer or a less safe environment on the pipeline?
In my opinion, it's equally safe, if not safer.
How is it safer if it's extended an extra year?
Well, kind of the root of the question is there atmospheric corrosion in the communities that we operate in? And the studies show that there's very low atmospheric corrosion. Unprotected pipe has a life of 24 years, according to these studies, and there are other rules that require us to coat that pipe, which extends the life significantly beyond that 24 years. And the safety aspect of it is there's very little risk now, and it won't change that risk if we extend that survey period by 1 year.
Do you find, or do you have the ability to tell me, do you find challenges that need to be rectified when you're doing this test every 3 years? Not challenges with the test itself, but challenges with the pipe. I mean, are there maintenance issues that you find every time that you conduct this test that need to be taken care of?
Typically, and this comes in from other opportunities and avenues for examining the pipeline as well. We haven't experienced what we consider actually pipe wall loss to corrosion in very few instances. What we get is reports to recoat the pipe to eliminate any avenues for atmospheric corrosion to start.
All right, thank you.
Other questions? Yeah, Mr. Isloff.
Mr. Bloom, I would have a couple of questions, if you don't mind. With regard to the leak survey test, which I understand has to be done only once every 5 years, but which you're conducting once every 4, why have you expedited that 1 year already?
The way the code is written had some pretty stringent deadlines for how that survey is conducted, and if we did initially have it on a 5-year period, and it got us into some areas where the monthly, the 5 years, or I think it's 60 months now. Anyway, the monthly period was being shifted during that year, and it was getting us a little bit out of line with compliance with that. So just we moved it back to a 4-year schedule just to make – give us some flexibility for how we're setting up our different areas that we're surveying. There really wasn't any risk associated with that other than scheduling compliance.
So in other words, you really switched to the 4-year cycle simply because of scheduling challenges to keep it within a 5-year cycle. Is that stated correctly?
Yes.
Okay, my second question would be with regard to the corrosion test that you're asking to move from 3 to 4 years. When you go out in the field and conduct these tests, typically, how long has the pipe been installed before you'll notice any corrosion problems from the time it's installed, from the time it's new to the time a problem is noticed? Excuse me. Do you have any idea what that median time would be?
No, I really don't. The current code requires all new piping to be coated when it's installed or within that first year. And typically when we go back 3 years later, there is no rust, but there may be some coating that needs to be repaired. But I really don't have quantify an average length before we would notice corrosion.
So you wouldn't know if it's 15 years or 10 or 5 or 24 for that matter? You wouldn't have any idea?
We're kind of relying on that, on the study that was done that shows that pipe wall, unprotected pipe wall in the atmosphere in the Midwest takes 24 years to experience 70% pipe wall loss, which would be considered the end of the life of that pipeline. But in our own system, I don't think we have the records or to come up with an average period when something is installed to when we can actually see corrosion starting.
One more question. Has the system ever had, for lack of a better term, a serious accident or an event that occurred because of corrosion problems?
I'm not sure I can answer that question without some more research. My knowledge, I do not recall in my 27 years of experience with MDU that we've had a reportable incident that is related to underground corrosion or above ground corrosion. I can that's what we're talking about here is atmospheric corrosion above ground. I do not have any recollection in my experience or anecdotal experience from other employees of above-ground corrosion leak causing an incident.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Mr. Smith.
I have one, and it relates to the condition 3. And as I understand condition, does that relate to areas where there might be additional contributors to corrosion other than just straight atmospheric corrosion? such as road salt, that kind of thing. Is that what that's designed to guard against, or where you have extra corrosion causing agents that might be present?
Mr. Solem might be able to answer that, but that's my understanding of the way it's written, is that if we did identify a hot spot, regardless of the cause, it would be something that we would report to Mr. Solem and increase our monitoring on it.
Mr. Solem, what's that all about, and how does that process work?
That condition was something that PHMSA put in as a condition to approve this in other states, like in Illinois, where some of these variances were approved. And the details of it, I'm not that familiar with. Mr. Bettman had handled that, but the hot spots would be reported to me, and we would follow up as necessary.
I'm just this may be kind of anecdotal, different company, but right near my house, there's a above ground pipe where it comes out of the ground, and it's right on a very busy street, and it is in a place where when the snowplow goes along, it pushes salted snow off the road onto it. I mean, is that what we're talking about here, that kind of thing?
That could be one instance, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, I have one more question. This is Commissioner Kolbeck. This only refers to time, correct? It doesn't refer to any procedures that will be taken as soon as if corrosion was detected.
Correct. That's my understanding.
Okay. It's basically when you're going to be doing inspections. It's not. It doesn't pertain to how you will fix corrosion leaks or response time to corrosion leaks or anything like that, correct?
Correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Other questions? Any action? Unless somebody's got another motion, I'd be interested in making a motion to defer action on this and request the company to provide some additional information. And I think, you know, Mr. Bloom, Mr. Solem, you're suffering a little bit from a heightened sensitivity that the commission, or at least this commissioner, likely has with regard to pipeline safety and inspection. And I thought the Illinois order that was submitted was quite instructive, but it made references to exhibits and to testimony, and we don't have those original documents. And I'm not asking for you to go to put to get all together the docket in that Illinois proceeding, but I just think some additional information on what we're doing here, on the rates of corrosion, answering the questions that Commissioner Hansen and Mr. Rizlov asked that we weren't able to quite get answered today. I think some additional information would make it more likely that at least this commissioner would have a greater comfort level of what we're doing here. So that's a motion and an explanation all in one. Is there any further discussion on that motion?
Mr. Chairman, I think that's well said, and perhaps we are just a little more sensitive right now over this as a result of issues that are before us. However, in this type of a situation, I think we need to err on the side of on public safety, and although it looks at this juncture, I don't really have a strong feeling of opposition to it. It's just that little hint in the back of my mind that I have some concerns, some questions I need answered, and I appreciate your motion.
Other discussion? And I'm sure the Illinois Commission is very good at what they do, but, you know, that was really the only supporting documentation we had submitted, and so that's why I think additional value, additional information would be nice. If there's no further discussion, we'll proceed to vote. Kolbeck?
Aye.
Hansen?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. With that, those people that were not able to get on the telephone line earlier, or that we were very nice enough to get off, if you want to call back on, I would guess we have ample capacity on the bridges at this point. So that will take up pipeline item number two, PS07-003. It deals with the Mid-American Energy Company's filing for approval of a waiver of 49 CFR section 192.285A2 and 49 CFR section 192.285 part C. We will look to anyone from Mid-American.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. This is Roger Lorenzen with Gas Standards from Mid-American Energy out of Sioux City.
Go ahead, Mr. Lorenzen. Thanks.
Yes, and this waiver is, for the most part, a request to allow Mid-American Energy to qualify its employees on a schedule that works. And what I mean by that is primarily we use off-season time to qualify employees. That would be months of January and February. The code requirement is that employees be qualified once a year, and that's been interpreted to mean 12 months or 365 days. So as employees are qualified, the next qualification time frame has to be performed before that 365 days. And, in fact, what that does is it ratchets the next schedule back. And it also is very difficult in many cases to meet the schedule for all employees due to sick and vacation. So it becomes a scheduling problem. And in order to meet that time frame, Mid-American would normally even schedule a month or two ahead of time. So in the rescheduling to meet the requirement, again, it ratchets that date back into eventually into the construction season. And eventually you have to qualify twice in 1 year in order to get you back into another schedule. So it's a matter of qualifying people in a time frame annually, not to exceed 15 months. That would allow Mid-American to schedule vacation sick, meet the requirements of all employees within a time frame of 365 days plus the additional months. I would see no difference in the safety that this would allow for public. And in addition to that, the code also talks about a person who may have a failed joint, or the code actually reads three failed joints, has to be disqualified and requalified. This waiver says that, in fact, if the person would have one failed joint, they would be requalified. And so basically that's the proposal as it is. There's also a letter of recommendation from former Pipeline Safety Program Manager Martin Bedman.
Thanks, Mr. Lorenzen. Mr. Solem is somewhere.
Mr. Chairman, this is Nathan Solem with staff. Mr. Bettman had submitted a recommendation stating that the proposed waiver is not inconsistent with pipeline safety and that similar waivers have been approved in adjacent states. Staff therefore recommends approval of the waiver request and, if approved, forwarding of the order to PHMSA.
Thanks very much. Questions? Hearing none. We can move to action and discussion.
I move in the docket PS07-003 that the commission approve the waiver.
Motion has been made. Any discussion?
The docket PS07-003.
That's right. Any discussion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Kolbeck?
Aye.
Hansen?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. The motion carries 3-0. Thanks very much. With that, we will come to telecommunications item number one, in the matter of the failure of certain telecommunications companies to timely file the gross receipts tax. We do have a listing of those companies on the agenda, and the question before the commission today is, shall it order an order to show cause as to why the commission should not fine or suspend or revoke the certificates of authority of each of these companies for failure to pay the requisite gross receipts tax? We'll look to Ms. Forney for her comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Commissioners. You have before you a list of
10 companies that have either not filed or have filed but not paid. And at this point, I would ask to remove Bell Atlantic Communications, Inc., doing business as Verizon Long Distance, Cellular, Inc., Network Corp., doing business as Verizon Wireless, and SS Telecom, as all those companies are now in compliance. The remaining companies, we have 3 long-distance providers that have filed but not paid, 3 long-distance providers that have not filed or paid, and then on the next, oh, 4, excuse me, including preferred carrier services. And I would just ask that we, the commission, issue an order to show cause in those companies.
At this time, we'll see if any of those companies wish to make any comments.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Ms. Rogers.
My name is Darla Rogers, and I represent SS Telecom. I apologize because there was a little bit of a lack of communication. We were traveling yesterday and to a funeral and not able maybe to get everything straightened out. But I received a voice message from Jerry Heiberger, who's the manager of SS Telecom. And it was my understanding that SS Telecom did not owe any taxes for the period because they were not up and running and had no gross receipts, and that was the reason that they had not paid. And I was just questioning if that is the case.
That is, Mr. Chairman, if I may, that is actually not the case. They received their certificate of authority, but even though they had not done business, they were still subject to the $250 minimum. And that check, I received a photocopy of the check yesterday, and it's being FedExed to me this morning.
Okay, and I guess I just need some clarification of when that $250 minimum is appropriate. And again, I would really appreciate your clarification, but to me, 49.1A3 states that the $250 minimum gross receipts tax does not apply to telecommunications companies providing local exchange services as defined in 49.31.113. And so my question is, why does the $250 minimum amount apply to SS Telecom, who does, in fact, provide local exchange service? Just wanted some clarification on that.
Would you need to pass your mic, Ms. Kramer? Or, oh, the book.
The book of all truth and wisdom.
I'm in SDCL 49-1A-3, and the last sentence is what I was looking at.
You know, rather than holding up the meeting as such, this is Karen Kramer from staff. I don't necessarily have any expertise here on this matter, but I'm willing to look into it and get back to Ms. Rogers, if you would like.
Well, seeing as though there are no other local, that there are no local exchange providers on the revised list, as mentioned by Ms. Fornia, it's not an issue that will be important to this proceeding. So I'm certainly not bothered by that. I guess I would see if there's concurrence with my colleagues.
No, I guess it's my understanding that SS Telecom, it's a legitimate misunderstanding.
Yeah.
It's nothing that was vengeful or I guess intentionally left out.
Absolutely.
This is something that needs to be cleared up.
Right. Absolutely not. We're certainly willing to pay whatever gross receipts tax is properly assessed under the statute. I just happened to come across this and wondered why they would be subject to the minimum.
Sure.
And if I may, Mr. Chairman, we did request that they be removed in
right.
this action anyway, so there's...
Other comments by any of the our counsel for any of the other providers?
Thank you.
Thanks. Hearing none, any questions? Ms. Forney, there are 7 companies you mentioned. This seems to be shorter than maybe lists in the recent past. Is there a particular reason for that?
Mr. Chairman, there has been a lot of work done by myself and our front office. We've sent numerous requests to these companies and worked very diligently to contact them, to look up new addresses. We've Googled them, we've any-hooed them, and we've just really worked very hard to get good information so we could get this list down. This is the smallest list I've seen since I've worked at the commission, I think. So I'm very pleased by that.
After you Googled them, what did you do?
We anywhooed them.
Is that legal?
You can anywho.com. Yeah.
Other questions? Hearing none, we can move toward action and discussion. And I'm happy to make the motion that the commission issue an order to show cause as to why the seven companies listed under long-distance providers that have filed but not paid, as well as long-distance providers that have filed...
that should be not filed or paid.
Not filed or paid. To show cause as to why those... why the commission should not fine, suspend, or revoke the certificates authority of those seven companies. Motion's been made. No second is required. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Colbeck.
Aye.
Hansen.
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries. We will save the last item on the main agenda for last, and we'll move to the addendum. We've already taken up item number one, as well as item number one under gas and electric, which was just an attempt to correct a misstatement on the original agenda and just simply made it worse. And now we'll proceed to we take the second telecom item first, telecom item number two, TC07-108, and the matter of the filing by XO Communication Services for an extension of an exemption from developing company-specific cost-based switched access rates. And the question for the commission today is, shall it grant that request? We'll look first. I didn't see anybody from XO Communications on the telephone line, so we'll look toward Mr. Sanger and Ms. Kramer.
Thank you, Commissioner. Previously, the commission issued an order granting XO Communications a 3-year exemption from developing company-specific cost-based interstate switched access rates and allowed them to mirror the Quest rates, the incumbent LEC rates. With this filing, XO Communications is requesting an extension of that exemption because their 3-year exemption has expired. Staff would simply recommend that the commission grant XO Communications the request for the extension and allow them to continue to use the ILEC Quest rates. New for XO Communications, staff would recommend that this extension have no time limit and that XO be allowed to file adjustments to its interstate switched access rates so long as those rates either mirror or are lower than the Quest incumbent LEC rates. That's essentially the same that we've been doing to all CLECs who agree to mirror the incumbent LEC rates. Thanks.
Thanks, Mr. Singer. Any questions? Hearing none, discussion and action.
On TC07-108, I move that the commission grant the request for the extension of an exemption from the company-specific cost-based switched access rates.
Just as a clarification, those are subject to the conditions.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Subject to the conditions mentioned by staff.
Great, thanks. Motion has been made. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Colbeck.
Aye.
Hansen.
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. With that, we just have three items remaining. We have leadership, Northwestern Natural Gas, and our third to last item under telecom number one in the matter of unauthorized long distance changes and unauthorized telephone charges made by reduced rates long distance. Today, shall the commission grant the petition for intervention to Mid-Continent, and shall the commission grant the motion to show cause, or additionally, or in the alternative, how shall the commission proceed? At this point, let's pause and make sure that Mr. Solomon is online.
I am online. Thank you very much.
Absolutely. All right. Well, let's, I guess let's take them as they're listed. We will first take up the petition for intervention filed by Mid-Continent. Anyone representing Mid-Continent present?
Mr. Chairman, members of the Commission, my name is Dave Gerdes, a local lawyer, and I represent Mid-Continent Communications in this docket. Mid-Continent has been the victim of the activities that are the subject matter of this docket and is asking to intervene in the docket as a complaining party. For the Commission's information, and there's also another separate docket that's been brought by Prairie Wave, in which they are asking for the same relief. We chose to ask to intervene in this docket as a complainant, and it would be essentially the same, to essentially the same effect, I believe.
Thanks, Mr. Gerdes. Does anyone object to the intervention request? Staff or reduced rates? Okay. Any questions? Hearing none, action and discussion?
I will move that the Commission grant the petition for intervention to reduce rates long distance to mid-continent. I have it written wrong here. In the TC07-107.
Motion has been made to grant the petition for intervention to mid-continent. Any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Colbeck?
Aye.
Hansen?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. With that, we'll proceed to the second question. Shall the Commission grant the motion to show cause? This time we'll look towards staff. Mr. Rounds, Ms. Singer, Mr. Singer, rather, Ms. Gregg, and Ms. Semler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I believe staff's motion speaks for itself. I'll just summarize that staff made this request for an order to show cause after receipt of 22 complaints. Although the individual complainants range from gas stations to antique shops, their complaints all follow three fact patterns, and those are all outlined in my motion, and I can certainly address any questions you may have regarding those specific complaints. Reduced rates continues to deny the facts as the consumers allege and relies on a third-party verification, although staff's yet to receive all those third-party verifications. And if they do exist, I guess staff would argue that they're meaningless due to alleged misrepresentation. In summary, Commission staff now seeks your help in further investigating the facts and would ask for an order to show cause to facilitate such an investigation. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Solomon, any comments?
I will, and
Ms. Moore is here, of course.
Ms. Moore.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Meredith Moore, appearing on behalf of Reduced Rate Long Distance. Also present on the phone is Mr. Adam Solomon from the Lustigman firm in New York. And I'll be primarily handling the opposition. However, if any company-specific questions should arise, I would direct those to Mr. Solomon as primary counsel and as someone who might be more familiar with the reduced rate business itself. Ms. Semler did, in fact, make a motion to show cause on behalf of staff in this case, alleging cramming and slamming activities. And those essentially relate to the provisioning of OnePlus dialing and toll dialing by Reduced Rates Long Distance, which is a corporation based in Florida. The crux of the motion to show cause would be the 22 complaints, consumer informal complaints, referenced by Ms. Solomon, which relate primarily to a 2005 to 2006 time period. There are, in fact, third-party verifications which relate to all of the informal consumer complaints which have been filed, as well as now the five formal complaints by certain members of that original informal complaining group. There was, I know, a great deal of exchange between Mr. Solomon on behalf of Reduced Rates and staff, commencing, I believe, in June and July of this year, wherein they discussed a potential settlement of this matter, and some third-party verifications were, in fact, exchanged at that time. I believe there may have been some confusion as to whether all of those were provided. I believe Mr. Solomon made an effort to provide all of those. I'm not sure whether those were, in fact, received. We do have those and would be happy to provide those, and that would certainly, within the meaning of the particular statute that is alleged to have been violated in this case, SDCL 49-31-89, essentially would indicate that there is no threshold issue for this commission to even reach, because that statute specifically indicates that a telecommunications company of any subscriber may not be changed without the telecommunications service subscriber's authorization. Those TPVs, or third-party verifications, would certainly indicate in this case that those services were, in fact, authorized by the complaining consumers. There have been efforts made by Reduced Rate to investigate this. They have canceled any services that the complaining individuals indicated were not, in fact, authorized or provided. There were apparently some collection efforts that may have been begun at one point in time. All of those have ceased, and Reduced Rates undertook an investigation of its telemarketing agents who essentially contact potential customers, and those would be small businesses, primarily in the more urban areas in the state, and they do operate in 48 states, so they follow those same practices in all other states. They made efforts to contact all of their telemarketing agents to verify the scripts that were being used by them and to ensure that, in fact, there were no company-specific representations being made. In other words, they weren't representing themselves to be Prairie Wave or Mid-Continent or any other long-distance provider. And that would, quite frankly, be a very sophisticated plot on behalf of Reduced Rates if it could be true, because Reduced Rates doesn't know if the customers or the potential customers, I should say, that it contacts are, in fact, being provided long-distance services by a particular customer. So, again, the facts simply don't wash there. And when it was discovered that there may have been a potential problem with one of the telemarketing rooms that was being utilized by Reduced Rates, that relationship was terminated in the early parts of 2007, I believe in February of 2007 and then in May of 2007. So to date, I think that Reduced Rates has certainly taken the appropriate steps in attempting to investigate and cease any behavior that could be called into question. And it's my understanding from having reviewed the documentation exchanged between Commission staff and Mr. Solomon that they were very close to achieving a settlement of this matter with regard to the individual complainants. However, shortly before that settlement could be finalized or pen put to paper in that regard, Prairie Wave filed a complaint in TC07-105, and then Mid-Continent filed its motion to intervene in this particular case. And one thing that I would encourage the Commission to look at is the procedural posture of both of those pleadings. What you have there, to a certain extent, particularly in the Prairie Wave complaint, is a complaint that I question its standing, because the allegations raised therein are really made on behalf of specific consumers, and those individuals would be far better versed to bring those complaints themselves. And based on a review of what I'm aware exists at the Commission, as well as the formal complaints that have been filed since October of this year in response to the motion to show cause filed by staff, those individual complainants have not been or have not filed formal complaints, I should say. So I think that when you look at the entirety of this, Reduced Rates did what it needed to do in order to investigate this, to cease any questionable activity. And Reduced Rates will tell you it has a zero-tolerance policy. In other words, it's not going to tolerate behavior which is going to give rise to consumer complaints. And while there's certainly no intention here on Reduced Rates to downplay any complaints that have been raised since the filing of the motion to show cause in October, only 5 complainants have in fact filed formal complaints. And there are third-party verifications that would indicate that all of those consumers have in fact authorize the services. However, services have been canceled. Any other efforts have been canceled in order to ensure that there are no problems there. This is a matter that I don't believe justifies what would likely be a significant expenditure of time and resources on the part of Commission or staff at this point. As I indicated, Reduced Rates operates in 48 other states. They have not had similar complaints in other states, and they take that very seriously. They have an oversight policy whereby they make the initial contact. They go through the initial questions regarding whether the potential customer would be interested in their services if the potential customer authorizes them to do so. There's a callback procedure as well as a written documentation policy. And so I think what you have is a significant oversight already in place by Reduced Rates such to prevent any future complaints. And again, I think you need to look at the time frame of the complaints themselves, which at this point is 2005 to 2006. So since Reduced Rates has undertaken the necessary actions to ensure that there aren't any further problems, we haven't seen any new complaints. And it would obviously take any future complaints very seriously and take the appropriate steps to investigate if anything else should arise. So given the very high bar with regard to a revocation of a certificate of authority, or the imposition of fines and penalties, I think what you have here is an instance that simply does not justify commission intervention at this point or further investigation. Thank you.
Thanks, Ms. Moore. Ms. Simler, any comments by staff in response?
Just that when staff receives 22 complaints, we are very concerned, and one of our other concerns is that there may be a variety of other South Dakota consumers out there currently paying this that could have been victim to the misrepresentation staff believes occurred, that don't necessarily know what's on their bill, that don't know that they've been paying it maybe for a course of time, and we feel the need to, for this, for a show cause, to further investigate all other South Dakota consumers, and in that we're requesting a list of all current South Dakota consumers as customers of Reduced Rates Long Distance. And I know, Deb, Greg, I don't know if you've got anything further to share regarding individual complaints as well, as Ms. Greg's office did take all of the complaints.
This is Deb Greg from staff. I would just have to agree with Ms. Semler that 22 complaints in our office regarding the same issues is a lot for our agency, and I think it's worth looking into.
Thanks very much. Questions? Sure, Mr. Smith, remind me that perhaps the intervener we've granted party status to, whether or not they have any comments regarding the order to show cause.
Very briefly, Mr. Chairman, Mid-Continent has had a number of its customers complain about the very same activities as well, and that's why we intervened. And so far as we know, that hasn't been resolved.
Thank you, Mr. Curtis.
Chairman, this is Kathy Ford on the phone.
Yes, go ahead, Ms. Ford.
I don't know if I have the ability to comment here since I have not asked to intervene in this particular docket, but since the Prairie Wave docket was mentioned, I do feel compelled to inform the commission or remind the commission that part of our complaint alleges activity as late as the end of July of this year, where the same representations or misrepresentations were being made to our customers. So I would take issue with the notion that these efforts were these misrepresentations ceased at the beginning of this year.
Well, thanks, Ms. Ford. And we certainly don't mind you offering that up. Now, if you get unruly, we may have to go back to the rule book. But
I'll try to contain myself.
Yeah, no, I think that was value added. Thanks. Perhaps we'll pause before going to questions and just see if Reduced Rates has any comments in response to any of the issues raised by anyone else. And if you don't have anything additional, that's fine.
I don't believe you do. We do, Mr. Chairman. We would rely on previous argument, and obviously we have a disagreement with regard to the characterization of the complaints in this case.
Thanks very much. Questions? And I would have one that comes to mind. Ms. Semler, Ms. Moore indicated that third-party verifications for the informal complaints in question had been turned over to staff. Is that true, and if so, for what number? For all 22?
I've got a spreadsheet here, and I've got, yes, verifications are received for three.
Ms. Moore, does that jive with your understanding of the information that's been exchanged?
I believe there's a dispute as to the exact number received. My understanding is that there are third-party verifications for almost all of the original complaints, and I do have the CD as well as other documentation to exist that, and I would certainly be more than happy to provide those to staff and to the commission as part of a formal filing to ensure that all information has been properly received and documented.
You used the phrase almost all. If third-party verifications don't exist for all of the 22, if there were one or two or three or some number where we don't have any, I mean, we have an affidavit from Ms. Gregg and informal complaints from consumers, in the absence of any contrary information by reduced rates, why should the commission not grant an order to show cause?
Primarily because out of the formal complaints that have been filed in response to invitation from staff following the motion to show cause filed in October, most of those individuals have not exercised their right to file a formal complaint. And again, there's no intention to downplay the fact that there were complaints raised in the first place. It's certainly not any comment on my part to indicate that Reduced Rate does not take those complaints very seriously and does not want to take care of any potential problems or quell any misunderstandings about what may have happened. To my knowledge, what we have is the original list, and what I have is a list of actually 19 complainants, and we do have the third-party verifications for the 19. So with regard to the 22, frankly, it's those other three that there may be there. I'm just not sure what those additional three are. And again, what I think is that any steps, again, when you look at those complaints, they're from this 2005 and 2006 time period, and I understand the comment made by the representative on behalf of Prairie Wave. However, there's been no complaint other than Prairie Wave itself filed in that regard. Those have been taken care of with regard to the efforts to terminate the telemarketing rooms and to start the written process for the third-party verifications as well as the actual recordings in place. So, again, what we want to reiterate that we certainly do take these complaints seriously. I simply don't think that it justifies the time in that would be involved in the formal investigation on this part.
Thanks, Ms. Moore.
This is Adams. May I interject one thing?
Yes, of course. Go ahead.
With respect to the verifications, I know that I had the primary communication with Attorney Semler with respect to those, and I'm trying to look at a date right now, but I believe I forwarded her CD with, I don't know exactly how many, but to the extent she has a request for any outstanding ones, we'd be more than happy to provide them to the staff. With respect to any ones that we don't have, my client is still in the process reviewing its records and going through, I guess, what we describe as off-site stored records, because many of these TPVs are from 2 or 3 years ago, and it's very difficult and costly for us to retrieve them. But we do have them for all of the complaints, and to the extent they have not been provided to the staff, we can provide so immediately.
Other questions? Commissioner Colbeck, did you have a question? Oh, I stole his question. You would have asked it better than I would have, so I should have deferred. Mr. Smith.
This may be for some combination of Ms. Semler and Ms. Moore. As I understand, at least a couple of the paragraphs of staff's allegations, they actually call into question whether or not the third-party verifications were in fact made. They call into question whether or not they were knowledgeably made by, we don't know, and we're not here today to decide whether or not that's the case. But at a minimum, doesn't that raise issues of fact that the commission can only decide after an investigation, discovery, and hearing on those issues to where they have the underlying facts that might indicate what the state of mind was of and what representations have been made to people in the process of making those statements they made on those recordings?
I certainly understand the concern, and obviously we can't get too much into the facts. However, I think the facts that were presented in the document and email exchange that occurred this summer between Mr. Solomon on behalf of Reduced Rates and Ms. Semler on behalf of staff included the scripts that are utilized by the telemarketing rooms that offer reduced rate services, which specifically indicate that no company representations are to be made. In other words, no specific company is to be identified other than Reduced Rate. Those are all approved by Reduced Rate itself. Additionally, when one listens to the third-party verifications, it becomes clear that there doesn't appear to be any sort of confusion or any attempt to mislead or deceive on the part of the telemarketing agent, such to give rise to any confusion as to on whose behalf the reduced rate agent is in fact calling. So in that regard, I simply don't think that the facts as set forth in the motion for order to show cause are actually reflective of the exchange of documentation that would have been had prior to its filing. So therefore, I don't see any concerns in that particular regard.
Other questions? Hearing none, we'll move to action and discussion. Anyone have any proposed action? And yes, go ahead, Mr. Smith.
You know, again, here today, this is just the commission to basically give a, I guess, a probable cause screening to whether or not a proceeding should be opened. I mean, wouldn't reduced rates, if we were to open this, then have available to it a motion for summary judgment if the company believes there are no genuine issues of material fact once we get to that point?
It certainly would, and we would obviously request such opportunity as well as an opportunity to conduct discovery or whatever else might be needed in order to ensure that all information is made available and in order to ensure that we have accurate representations made by all complainants, both formal and informal. However, I would submit that that may simply not, again, be a good use of resources at this particular stage. The statute under which the motion to show cause has been brought raises it as a threshold issue whether the services which were actually provided or authorized were in fact authorized by the customer, and we would submit that the motion itself fails as that threshold issue because of the existence of the third-party verifications, and so therefore we don't think that there's even a probable cause here for the commission to grant the motion to show cause.
Thank you.
And if there are no further questions, we can proceed to action or discussion. Go ahead, Commissioner Hansen.
Mr. Chairman, I will make a motion with an editorial comment. I thought the information was very well articulated. I appreciate the presentation by Ms. Moore. It was compelling to a significant extent. However, I just feel that there's too many questions that still exist on this issue and we need to explore. And for that reason, I will make the motion that the commission grant the motion to show cause in this docket.
Motion has been made. Additional discussion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Colbeck?
Aye.
Hansen?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. Thanks.
Thank you, Commissioner.
And with that, we will proceed to, we'll go back and we'll go to the agenda. And under natural gas, item number 1, NG07-013, that deals with the application by Northwestern Corporation for authority to increase its natural gas rates. The question before the commission is today, shall it grant the joint motion for approval of the settlement stipulation? Settlement stipulation and staff memo have been filed, unless staff or the applicant want to handle it a different way. I guess we'd look to Northwestern first for their comments and then staff. We should make sure that Mr. Towers and Mr. Copeland are on the line.
Bob Towers, I'm online.
Great, thanks. Basil Copeland? Okay. We got Mr. Towers at the very least. So, Mr. Kennecke, if you want to, you can certainly provide an overview of the settlement stipulation.
I'll probably just introduce my clients.
Sure, that'd be fine.
Commissioner, after I'll just have a few prefatory remarks. Northwestern did file an application to increase natural gas rates a little bit over 6 months ago. We filed a substantial amount of pre-filed testimony and exhibits. We went over them with staff. I want to compliment staff for their diligence and dedication in working those over with us. As a result of several negotiating sessions, we were able to reach a settlement with staff. As is always the case in rate cases, there's just a number of people working on those matters to bring them to resolution. We had a number of people on the table for Northwestern, and they include Kendall Cleaver and Jeff Decker. They certainly also include Pam Beinrud and Christy Wallman, who are also in the back. But I'll ask Mr. Decker and Mr. Cleaver to come up and probably handle any questions that they can. They're probably more likely to have the answers which commissioners might seek. I'll certainly stay in the room and be available for those, but thank you for hearing us this morning.
Thanks, Mr. Kennecke. Mr. Cleaver, Mr. Decker, welcome. Surely not the first time in that seat for at least Mr. Decker. We've kept it warm for you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I would start with a lighter note to Commissioner Kovic's earlier question on corporate headquarters. I'm a native Nebraskan, and we filed for rate cases in Montana, South Dakota, and Nebraska this year. And personally, I was lobbying to move the headquarters to Lincoln, but I lost. So, in all seriousness, I would echo Mr. Kennecke's comments earlier. We did file our rate case. We waited for staff to file their testimony and then entered into negotiations with staff. I found the process very enlightening myself. This was my first time involved in a rate case and doing the three, doing the three jurisdictions at once. There were a number of differences in process amongst all jurisdictions, but it was, I guess any comment about settlement discussions being refreshing might be a little going a little overboard, but certainly staff was receptive to Northwestern's positions and were very fair in dealing with our initial filing. We did have a lot of extensive discussion on a few issues, and I think we worked it out to the best we could between staff and Northwestern, and resulted in a very fair settlement for customers. So, Jeff, do you have anything to add?
Just it all kind of boils down to the settlement agreement in the end, and although the settlement agreement is a nice summary of the activity, it doesn't really play out all the work and time and exchanges that took place. So we appreciate what's stated in there, but just understand there's a lot of work behind that. A rate case is a lot of work, takes a lot of time, but it's a necessary part of the utility business. It's not always a positive for customers, but on the other hand, if you go to Burger King, and my favorite meal is the Junior Whopper meal. 2 years ago it was $2.99, now it's $3.29, at least in here, and it's price increases are a necessary part of keeping up with the costs that increase our business. So I guess, we're not going to make a lot of comments, just kind of open it up to commissioners for questions, and let's talk about what you're interested in.
And this time we will look toward staff, and once I can find the agenda, I can make it clear who's all been working hard on this. Mr. Jacobson, Mr. Singer, Mr. Knadel, Mr. Solem, Mr. Wegman, and Ms. Kramer. Any comments?
Thank you. This is Karen Kramer from staff, and staff would recommend approval of the joint motion for the settlement stipulation. Again, like Brett, I wouldn't be the one to ask questions to. That's merely the legal standpoint on it. And as you said, Mr. Sanger, Solem, Knadel, and Jacobson are available, and as is Bob Towers on the phone for any questions.
Staff comments?
Yes, thank you. This is Keith Sanger from Commission staff. We're here today to ask for your approval for the settlement reached in docket NG07013. On November 29th, Commission staff filed a memo and exhibits supporting the settlement. The memo outlines Northwestern's case It summarizes staff's case, and it discusses the details of the settlement that you have before you today. That memo spells out issue by issue each party's filed case, but more importantly, focuses on the movement that both staff and Northwestern made in coming to the settlement. I'm certainly not going to go over every one of those issues. Those are all in the memo, but I would like to give a brief overview and highlight some of the more significant issues. First of all, Northwestern's case. On June 1, 2007, Northwestern filed for a $3.7 million increase in the South Dakota natural gas distribution rates. That increase represented approximately a 6.7% increase in 2006 test year revenues, or a 31.6% increase in the distribution rates exclusive of gas costs and ad valorem taxes. Northwestern's filing was based on a 2006 test year, and as adjusted for Northwestern's claimed known and measurable changes. The increase represented an 8.99% overall rate of return, reflecting an 11.25% return on common equity. Staff performed a comprehensive analysis on Northwestern's filing. We obtained substantial amount of additional information through discovery. On October 19th, staff filed its testimony and exhibits supporting its case. In developing that position, staff accepted some of the company's claims and adjustments, made corrections or modifications to other company adjustments using more current and accurate data. Staff rejected some of the company's adjustments that we believe were not known and measurable, and proposed new adjustments not contemplated by Northwestern. Like Northwestern's case, staff's case, too, started with a 2002 test year and made certain known and measurable adjustments. 2006. Staff's case, as filed, represented a revenue deficiency of approximately $952,000 with an overall rate of return of 7.83%. Staff and Northwestern met on October 25th, where the differences between the companies and the staff's positions were discussed thoroughly, with the objective of obtaining a comprehensive resolution of the issues based on sound regulatory principles. Those discussions continued through the month of November. As a result of those discussions and exchanges, each party modified certain positions it had previously taken, and each party accepted other positions of the on various specific issues. Ultimately, staff and Northwestern were able to reach an agreement on all the issues, including a revenue deficiency of $3,077,543, representing an overall rate of return of 7.96%. The increase represented approximately 5.6% increase in 2006 test year revenues, or approximately a 21.2% increase in the distribution rates exclusive of gas costs and ad valorem taxes. More specifically, the residential, commercial, and combined industrial classes received a 28.1% increase, with the contracted deviations customers whose rates are set in the contracts received a 0% increase. The combination of all these resulted in the 21.2% overall increase that I discussed earlier. These increases included a $1 increase in the residential customer charge and a $2 increase in the small general commercial class customers, with the remaining of those two classes, the remaining increases in those two classes were placed in the volumetric block rates. The other customers, the remaining customers, did not see an increase in the customer charge, but instead saw all of their increase in the volumetric rates. Attached to staff's memo is Exhibit 8. That further breaks down the increases into the various rate groups. I would like to note that this settlement addresses several fairly substantial issues. One, the Northwestern purchase of the Freeman AMPI distribution system, the merger of the Nakota customers from the Nakota merger, the deferred Nakota PG cost issues that the Commission dealt with in previous dockets, and maybe probably most importantly, the settlement addresses, provides some clarity, and hopefully bring some closure to the manufactured gas environmental cleanup issues that Northwestern is facing. The settlement spells out how Northwestern will refund the manufactured gas plant insurance proceeds received from the Huron environmental cleanup site. As I stated earlier, this memo focuses on movement that staff made from its final position. For organizational reasons, that memo addresses each issue as they were presented in Exhibits 5 and 7 as attached to the memo. All of the highlighted items on these exhibits, they're highlighted, I think, probably in gray if you don't have a colored copy, are issues that were changed as, from staff's position as a direct result of the settlement. If I could just for a minute direct you to Exhibit 1 attached to the memo, which it follows page 16 of the memo. It's Exhibit 1, page 1 of 1. Exhibit 1 is a summary of all the movement that staff made from its case of 952, its case that it recommended an increase of $952,000 to the settlement position. It highlights in order of magnitude the changes from Exhibit 5, the changes that were made in Exhibit 5 and Exhibit 7 from staff's filed cases as spelled out in the memo. But I would like to clarify several hidden facts within that exhibit. If you look at the first two items listed on that exhibit, they are the MGP cleanup costs and the Huron manufactured insurance refunds. These were not anticipated in Northwestern's original filing. The next two items are federal income tax corrections made to Northwestern's original filing during settlement discussions. The fifth item is a labor adjustment not asked for in Northwestern's original filing. They did ask for a labor increase, but this is in addition to their labor increase that was not in the original filing. Those five adjustments, the net sum of those five adjustments is $1.9 million, and all of these are additions to Northwestern's original $3.7 million increase request. That essentially moved the starting point of Northwestern's original case from $3.7 million increase to approximately a $5.6 million increase. I say that to help clarify and help show the adjustments and the movements that were made, because our starting point, the way staff is looking at it, really wasn't $3.7 million with a $3 million settlement. It was a $5.6 million request with a $3 million settlement. I'd like to talk a little bit about comments that we received from consumers throughout this process. The commission, to our best count, has received under 10 contacts from Northwestern customers regarding the rate increase. Most of these were received at the beginning of the process, shortly after the docket was filed. Staff, either commission, the analyst staff assigned to the case or the consumer affairs staff have replied to all of those, whether it be via an email or a letter or oral communications via telephone. But more recently, the commission received a letter expressing some frustrations with the perceived increases in Northwestern's bill stuffer notifying the customers of that increase. Staff is currently attempting to contact that customer to help better explain some of the possible misconceptions that that individual may have. But given the fact that there was a concern raised there, I think it may be worth just a minute of your time to help to maybe further dive into some of the rate design issues. If I could get you to turn to Exhibit 9 of the memo. Exhibit 9 is the last three pages. Specifically, the first page of Exhibit 9, it breaks down the increases for Rate Code 81, which are the residential rates. The right-hand side of that exhibit shows what a typical residential customer over a 12-month period would see. As you can see, the average yearly increase for a residential customer would be 5.8%. This equates to a $55.32 average yearly increase, or a $4.61 average monthly increase. Now, granted, there are some months they're going to see a higher increase and a lower increase as far as dollars, but that shows the average of a 66-term residential customer. The left-hand side of that same exhibit identifies the increases on a per-therm basis or on a set-therm basis. If you look at line 5, a customer who does not use any gas – but because of the $1 increase in the customer charge from $6 to $7, we'll see about a 16 2/3% increase in their bill. than they would have received prior to the rate increase. However, as you see, as the gas usage increases, the percent of the increase goes down. This is caused by the effects of the fixed customer charge increase being softened by the increase in usage and because of the declining block rates that Northwestern has. Northwestern has been using declining block rates for its residential customers for many years, and as you can see, probably not so much on this, but in other data, once the first 30 therms has a higher rate than the remaining therms after that. It's the purpose of a declining block is to help ensure recovery of all those fixed charges that are not included in the customer charge. They are spread out more heavily into the first 30 therms. When you compare this to a flat rate, a customer would see under this method, a customer would see a higher bill in the summer months, low usage months, and a lower bill in the winter months, the higher usage. It's probably not a very significant change, but it does work somewhat to help levelize the bills from the summer to the winter. Now, by no means are the summer bills anywhere close to the winter month bills, but that is an effect that does have, besides the fact that of ensuring recovery of the fixed charges. Page 2 of that exhibit breaks down the small commercial customers. In this case, those customers received a $2 increase, so that would help explain why there is the higher increase for no usage, and then again, it softens as the usage goes on. Page 3 of that exhibit is an explanation of rate 84 option A increase for the large commercial industrial firm service. This breakdown is a little deceiving because it includes the effect of very large volumes and the adjustment clauses. But one thing you have to remember, exclusive of PGA costs and ad valorem costs, which are through the adjustment clauses, each customer class has received the same increase. But because of the volume usages, it's somewhat deceiving on what their increase will be. So I guess what I'm saying is every customer who has different usages will see a different increase. But I think it's important to remember that the average residential consumer will see a 5.8% increase. Residential consumer will see a 5.8% increase. I think that will kind of help explain some of the confusion that we received, that the commission staff received in a letter just recently by a consumer of Northwestern Gas. Staff believe that the settlement provides Northwestern with a rate increase that is fair, just, and reasonable. That rate increase allows Northwestern the opportunity to earn a return and to continue to provide safe and reliable and adequate service to its South Dakota residential customers. It also strives to eliminate costs that should not be borne by the customers with the goal of minimizing rate shock while attempting to provide stabilized rates. I would like to take just a second or two to also thank the Northwestern employees, particularly Kendall, Jeff, Christy, and Pam. We've worked with all of them quite extensively during this process. They've been good to work with, prompt with responses to staff in staff data requests, and I'd like to thank them for that. But with that, we hope that the commission approves this settlement, and both staff and Northwestern are here for any questions that you may have.
And I think all the commissioners are aware that these settlement stipulations are a little bit like a house of cards, and each entity is given something to get something, and we understand that. So our questions aren't we're not going to attempt to drive a wedge between the agreement, but I do think we want to flesh out a little bit maybe what this means. So with that, are there commissioner questions?
It's my understanding, are the current rates, are they 10 years old?
1999, December of 99 is when last went into effect.
Okay, and that was based on 1998, though, correct?
Last year, correct.
Okay. Is it specifically
you had touched on this, Keith, but is it specifically done this way so that it kind of softens a little bit of the blow in the winter months when people need the heat, and then in the summer months when the bill is lower, is that specifically how it's done?
It spreads it out, you know, with the dollar, increasing the customer charge spreads that load out, so you're not just hitting the heating customers, but you're spreading it out amongst those customers who may have just a fireplace or they may have just a water heater, so that everybody shares in that increase.
Okay. Did I hear that correctly? The ask was $5.6 million, but the earn was $3 million?
Well, you got to keep in mind that specifically their filing asked for $3.7 million, but through the settlement process, there were additional things that Northwestern asked for. They either corrected in their filing that was an error that actually increased what they I can't say it increased what they could have gotten, but it increased the starting point where staff was looking at. But yes, it increased it, you know, through those five things. And it's not an apples to apples comparison, so you got to kind of take that softly when you're looking at that. But it did increase what staff believed, what Northwestern, if Northwestern would have gotten everything they wanted in their original filing and the additions and corrections that they made during settlement, it would have been somewhere in the neighborhood of $5.6 million increase.
Okay. And just my last question: this only affects 25% of the set bill, correct? The other approximately 75% is the gas cost that changes on a daily basis, basically. Well,
that monthly
with hedging and yeah. Okay.
That's correct.
Okay.
I think it's probably best to say this is for the distribution portion of the customer's bill. This does not have anything to do with the ad valorem tax adjustment or the gas cost. Those change monthly. But when we talk about the percent increase that the customers are getting, the 5.8% that the average residential customer will receive, that is as if we stood still in time and kept gas costs and ad valorem taxes at a constant.
Okay.
Of course, as gas costs rise or fall, that 5.6% increase is going to rise and fall too. But in order to provide an apples-to-apples comparison, we held gas costs the same and looked at just the distribution changes made.
Okay. But the 5.8% average increase is only on 25% of the bill, correct?
No. That would be the entire customer
bill. Okay.
We increased the portion of the customer's bill, and I don't know if it's 25.75.
Sure.
That sounds like amount, but the portion that we increased was 25% of their bill. But when we look at the 5.8, that is over the entire customer bill.
Okay.
The 28.1% increase that we talked about earlier is what the residential customer would see exclusive of ad valorem taxes and gas costs, if that helps.
Yes. Thank you.
There's a lot of different ways of measuring the increase. We try to provide as much information as possible. It becomes confusing at times, but that's our attempt there.
Thank you.
Other questions?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I always have a lot of questions, but I let the others go first. That way they can ask my questions. I don't look like I'm asking a lot of questions. Commissioner Colbeck touched on the fact that the 99 was the last time that there was an increase, and 98 was the test year. And I appreciate the analogy of the McDonald's Junior Whopper. Do you happen to know what the CPI did during the Consumer Price Index did during that period of time as well?
I think from 99 through 2006, it was about 21%.
That's helpful for those of us who don't eat the Whopper. So.
The Whopper was only a two-year period. I didn't take that back to 99.
You didn't go back to 98 would be the test year. A three-year moratorium, was that also included? Do I understand that correctly, that a three-year moratorium was included in this?
Yes.
Okay. I appreciate pointing out the average cost Ultimately, it boils down to cost. The consumer is most interested. How much is it? What's the effect on my bill? And the 5.8% was, I'm sure, very enlightening for them. I'm sure they appreciate that. Heard the 16% increase, and, of course, that's startling. People need to understand, of course, that that's only on the customer charge. Went from $6 to $7, so it's a dollar increase. That's just over 16%. I am curious a little bit about the city of Freeman. Before I jump into that, I just have to say that there was so much to read and review on this. I can't imagine what it was like to be in the trenches on this for both for staff and for the utility to go through this process. Although I frankly find a lot of it very interesting, it must have been a tremendous amount of work, and I'd like to congratulate everyone who had anything to do with this process and putting it together for us. And we also appreciate very much the fact that you saved us a great deal of time of not having to arbitrate and go through a long rate hearing. So my kudos to all of you who worked on it. Could you tell me a little bit about the city of Freeman and how that affected and the purchase?
Okay. The city of Freeman, I think, was back in February 1 is when that actually became effective, but the city was looking to sell their gas system, and of course you don't get the opportunity to purchase property that often, and so we were interested in that. But the purchase price, the city of Freeman, I think, was approximately $750,000. In addition, there was a pipeline that was owned by the AMPI company, and I don't have the numbers perfect, but that was approximately $750,000 as well. We purchased both those items because that pipeline feeds the gas. It's part of what feeds the gas to the city of Freeman. So we really needed to purchase both items. We did not, at the point of purchase, we did not come forth with an acquisition, requesting an acquisition adjustment. And so in the rate case, what's put into rate base was the book value of the property. The rates for the Freeman customers, they have been charged the Freeman, City of Freeman rates until December 1 per statute. As of December 1, these new rates went into effect, and so the City of Freeman customers are now paying the same rate that all other Northwestern customers pay in South Dakota. Their rates, distribution delivery rates, actually went down slightly, even with the rate increase. So the customers there, I don't think you'll be hearing much from, but it was a benefit to them.
Well, that's you hit my main question. What was the effect on the consumers in the city of Freeman? I appreciate that. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Staff addressed in its memo a little bit of discussion about the Nakota customers and customers that are receive service under contract with deviation. Staff recommended the commissioner order Northwestern to perform and file with its next general rate increase request a complete cost of service study, signing and identifying assignment of cost to contract with deviation's customers. Did staff give any consideration to maybe asking for at least some of that information? Maybe it was as a part of this process. I mean, I'll ask a more general question. Does staff feel as though the treatment of the contract with deviation customers is fair given the other system customers?
Well, we wouldn't have done it if we didn't think it was fair. But one thing you have to remember is the contract to deviation customers that came over with Nakota were very large volumes. In fact, the contract to deviations customers make up a very significant portion of Northwestern's load. When we took a look at Northwestern's adjustment in moving the plant and in moving the revenues and the costs over into Northwestern,
we believed, although it's hard to identify all the indirect costs that should appropriately be assigned, thus why we requested for future that we have a class cost of service study that better addresses that. But when we looked at their adjustment, we believe that moving those customers into Northwestern's rate base and allowing those customers in provided significant advantages to the rest of the customers in that the revenues there were high enough to cover all of the costs of the direct cost and provide a very large portion, if not probably a larger portion of indirect costs than the other customers were paying. So I guess what I'm indirectly saying is that we believe had staff not allowed the NACOTA customers over, we would have seen a larger increase to the rest of the customers. And besides softening the rate increase to the rest of the customers, it adds large efficiencies to the company in that there's large volumes moving through. And large volume customers are usually cheaper to serve than the lower volume, for example, a residential customer, because you have a lot of the same costs, but when you're selling more gas, the revenues you received are greater. And great load factor, too.
I suspected load factor probably played a pretty big role. Can anybody discuss a little bit more the decision to not increase the monthly customer charge for the very large customers?
I guess we...
And I should make it clear, I mean, that's not a loaded question for anybody who's listening. I mean, they're paying their increased freight, too. It's just in the volumetric charge rather than the monthly customer charge.
When we initially kind of did that cost of service study and looked at the customer classes, those classes were paying fairly close to what their cost was. I don't know that any of these, I mean, even the $8 doesn't get as close to what we feel that the cost is for that monthly charge. So we felt that they were close to paying for what they were. In addition, we moved some of the residential and small commercial classes up to get us more in line with what other companies charge, where on the larger customers we were already close. So we just felt that it was time to make things more equitable, more balanced. That's why we did it the way we did.
I think it's also important to note that for the residential customer, they moved from $6 to $7. The small commercial / general customers moved from $7 to $9. The other customers, and help me out here, Jeff, are paying an $80 and a $130. Is that correct? I may have those numbers wrong.
Yeah, there's two different classes. Yeah, the smaller ones are $80 and $180. Numbers escaping me, but it's like $330 for one of the largest customers, and I think there's a charge for $330. I'd have to look here. But there's some large customer charges.
And I think on sheet 3.1, I think it lists $280 for the option B.
There. Yep.
Rate 84 customers, yeah. So, yeah, I mean, I didn't mean to insinuate it wasn't a big customer charge. $280 is a pretty big charge.
This is Bob Towers.
Yeah, go ahead, Mr. Towers.
Yeah. Just a couple of observations on this point. The staff did an analysis of what staff believes to be the costs that should be recovered in a customer charge, or at least are justifiably recovered there. And in staff's filed case, that analysis appears in an exhibit that I presented, referred to as Exhibit RGT2. Among other things, it shows that the really basic customer costs for the residential class, we believe, are approximately $8.50. So the movement of the customer charge.
I'm sorry, Mr. Charles, what was that number again?
$8.48.
Thanks.
To be precise, that's what shows up in the exhibit. So the movement of the existing customer charge for that rate class from $6 to $7 is a concession that the company was willing to agree to that softens the impact, the
of the rate adjustments on the smallest users. For the small commercial customers, my analysis indicated a customer cost of $9.62. And thus, the movement of their rate up to $9 wasn't quite to the level of the cost, even for that class. The remaining classes that I looked at in that exhibit, the customer cost comes out more or less in line with what were the existing customer charges, and that's why they're not changed.
And yeah, and looking at your exhibit, option A would be $65.22, and option B would be $173.39.
Yes, and I'm kind of treating that pretty generally. The company wasn't proposing an increase, and we felt those that cost analysis kind of supported what the company was proposing to do. The company's analyses of what they perceive to be the costs that are properly recoverable in a customer charge would yield much higher numbers. Because of the categories of costs that they would seek to recover in that base charge. And, that's what I wanted to make.
No, thanks very much, Mr. Towers. Question about the 3-year moratorium, and, you know, we see in other states, Illinois, Maryland, a number of states that have restructured markets that rate freezes can have pretty devastating impacts once they're lifted. I think this is very different for a number of very important reasons. But could maybe staff discuss why they felt there was a benefit to a 3-year moratorium?
Well, certainly we wouldn't have mind having longer, but it's important to note that staff believes it's very important to have stable rates. And although we have read some of those same articles and things that have gone on in other states, we don't believe that's going to happen in this case. Without knowing exactly why in those other states there are large, I presume some of it may have to do with gas costs because they may not have a gas cost adjustment there where we allow that to fluctuate here. I can't say exactly in all those cases, but we believe 3 years works very appropriately in this. It's similar to what other companies have done. It's similar to what we've been seeing as an average from other companies filing gas costs. In the end, like I said, we wouldn't have mind seeing longer, but when we looked out and tried to see what was going to be happening in the future with Northwestern, it probably wasn't appropriate to go much longer because of the MGP cleanup costs. The predictions on the future are great, and although we have addressed and we those in this case, and we included what we believe to be an appropriate amount in the cost of service, future estimates from Northwestern show that those costs could be significant in the future, and these rates as designed today probably may not be adequate to recover those cleanup costs in the future. Both the company and staff believe that 3-year was a good number, and we will see what happens after the 3-year moratorium's up.
This is Bob Towers again.
Yeah, go ahead.
I gathered some concern about even the possibility that even a 3-year rate freeze could result in year 4 in a massive rate increase. I think that concern is minimized by paragraph 19 in the settlement stipulation, which is basically a force majeure clause. So yes, there is a moratorium, 3-year moratorium, but if certain things happen, the company is free to seek rate relief within that 3-year period.
Yeah, safety valve, so to speak.
Yes.
It appears by the tariff sheet that Wagner is not a natural gas community for Northwestern. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay. You know, this is numbers that I calculated. I didn't use a calculator, so I want to I want to make sure that my generalizations of the numbers are right. So kind of help me here. Because I think we did receive some comments from, consumers that Mr. Sanger referred to that were concerned about. Is the increase falling more on the shoulders of small customers rather than large customers? So, and percentages sometimes don't tell a very good story. So I thought, well, what do most people care about? They care about dollars per month. You know, that's the bill they want to pay. So using your averages in the staff memo, Mr. Sanger, Mr. Knail, Mr. Jacobson, and everyone else, I've got that the rate 81 customers, that would be residential, would be about $4.50 a month. The rate 82, I think it is, small commercial would be about $10 a month increase. And that the large industrial, what I think is rate 84, would be about $45 a month. Does it sound generally like those representations are right?
I think I would agree that generally you're talking, you know, give or take a dollar in some sense here and there. I believe you are accurate there.
And if this settlement stipulation were approved, I mean, nobody wants to pay $4.50 more for natural gas service than they were paying, you know, last year. But in comparison to a $10 increase or a $45 increase, it appears as though settlement stipulation really attempts to equitably distribute the increased needs for revenue requirements. So
that's correct. In the cost of service study, we attempted to get each class to be earning the same percentage.
This is probably a sensitive topic, so anybody can take a pass on this if they want to, but it seems as though a blended 7.96 rate of return is not particularly robust given what I read about in trade publications for other jurisdictions. Now, hopefully it's that way because there's not a lot of regulatory risk in South Dakota, and this is a place where Northwestern feels comfortable and they don't need much of a premium on what they're earning. Is that an appropriate assumption on my part, or is there another reason why this blended rate appears to be quite fair to consumers? And again, anybody can take a pass on that.
It is a sensitive topic, and we did have a lot of extensive discussion on it. We would agree that obviously South Dakota is a more friendly regulatory environment than some. However, we wouldn't mind if you didn't, or if the commission wanted to increase that rate of return. So.
I think staff's probably going to refer to Mr. Towers, but what I would like to indicate that it's not always appropriate to look at what other jurisdictions are doing because of the differences that they do. Because when you see a rate of return in another jurisdiction, you are not sure what happened because of the just putting a hypothetical capital structure cap on a company can make a huge difference with leaving the return on equity the same. So, and then we got to be careful what we're talking about here because some of this is confidential information that staff agreed to keep confidential. So I'm not going to dive into any specifics. If you would like more information, we certainly can clear the room and get into the specifics. You are more than welcome to all that information that we have. But if you do look at the overall rate of return compared to other jurisdictions, I believe that your comment saying indicating that we are on the low end is probably appropriate. I wouldn't say the lowest, but I would say we are on the lower end. And I believe that's a great thing for the South Dakota customers, for Northwestern's customers. But staff is very we watch out very carefully because we do know that Northwestern needs to earn an appropriate return to continue to provide reliable and safe and adequate services. And if Mr. Towers has anything more to add, I'll turn it over to you.
Yeah, Bob Towers again. I don't think I have much to add to that, except suffice it to say that staff felt comfortable with that rate of return after analyzing, doing its own analysis of Northwestern's cost of capital. I guess I'll just leave it at that. There are many there are a number of elements that go into a determination of the cost of the overall cost of capital. And that rate of return is consistent.
Sure, and I'm certainly not clamoring for it to be higher. I certainly understand that. Mr. Smith, did you have something? And I do want to point out that I don't think – well, go ahead.
I was just going to say, and I know we can't talk specifics, but I think the concern, of course, with having it too low is it pressures the company then to cut corners, does it not, in order to – if they believe a return has to be higher in order to I guess it's not quite to compete for finances.
I would say that is certainly a risk. If you push the rate of return too low, then obviously, as an investor-owned utility, our shareholders expect a certain return too, and we have to monitor fairness for shareholders and customers alike.
Well, and I think in the appropriate regulatory framework, the long-term interests of an IOU and ratepayers are relatively well aligned. I mean, ratepayers really do benefit by having a financially sound company, service provider, and that's probably worth noting. So, and I also want to mention I was talking about restructured markets earlier, and I think the basic premise, you know, is still valid, you know, asking about what effect might a rate freeze have, but probably worth noting that those restructured markets were electric and that those rate freezes were on electric, and this is obviously natural gas, but some of the same issues still apply. Other questions? Yeah, Mr. Islow, go ahead.
Yes, this is Greg Rislov. I just wanted to make a point on the rate of return to begin with, that a safe, stable, reliable utility like Northwestern Energy certainly doesn't need the same return as a risky dot-com company would in the Silicon Valley. Just to get that out. With regard to Freeman, and I think there was actually an article on the news this morning about the benefits of being incorporated into the system, the benefits for the people of Freeman. I guess my question would go the other way. What effect did incorporating Freeman into the cost of service have upon the legacy customers of Northwestern?
I guess, Keith, you can jump in with me as well here. But I don't know that it should have had an impact on the others because you're just putting the rate base in, you're just earning the regular return on those customers. So I don't know that there's any additional costs that are burdened upon the other customers, and I don't know that the analysis showed that there was.
This is Bob Canadle. I think there is a minimal effect by adding Freeman in there. We did update the billing determinants for Freeman, and we also weather normalized those, which the company didn't, so it brings it more in line with the rest of the system.
So what you're saying, you know, looking at the comment, I would be very surprised, shocked, actually, if the per unit cost was the same for Freeman coming in as it was for the legacy system. But what you're saying is a de minimis impact?
That's my belief, correct.
And as you look at the benefits of them coming into our supply group, and, I mean, there's a lot of things we're already doing that we don't have to do extra because we add Freeman, where for the city of Freeman, they needed a gas person, a person there to do the billing and a person there to watch out for the purchases and to do efforts that they weren't already doing.
To another topic, what was changed with regard to seasonal customers' connection charge, and if there was a change, why was it changed?
Okay. Seasonal customers, the grain dryers, swimming pools, et cetera, what we allow them to do, let's just talk about the grain dryers, swimming pools, it's the same thing, but a grain dryer can call us on October 15th, say, I'd like my dryer turned on, and then we'll charge them the $80 customer charge per month plus the delivery costs for October, November, December, that 60 days or 90 days, whatever they choose to be on. And then at the end of their drying season, they can call us and say, okay, I'd like you to turn my dryer off. So for the next 9 months, they don't pay any customer charge or delivery charge. A lot of times these customers obviously are in the country or not right across town. So we put in an $80 seasonal charge, $80 charge to hook them up at the beginning of the season to at least cover more of the costs than what we're covering today. And it's not $80 from $10, I guess, is a big jump. But when you compare the fact they're not paying customer charges for the other 9 months, the fact that they're not just out the back alley to hook them up, that there is some driving time, we're trying to cover more of those costs.
Following that, what would it take then, based on your explanation, to eliminate the free ridership of these seasonal customers? Something in excess of 80? Do you have any idea?
Yeah, something in excess, and I don't remember how high we'd need to go on that. I think the analysis showed, like, just to cover that cost is $125, just to cover the hookup charge on an average. So we went from 10 to 80, maybe. We'd have liked to have gone to 125. I think that's what we proposed. But
still really haven't touched the subsidization issues for those months where no customer charges are being paid. You're really just recovering the cost of connecting.
That's correct.
I did want to make a point. I think it was stated that it costs less to serve, or at least no more to serve, larger customers and smaller customers. In case anybody's listening, it really does cost more to hook up and provision facilities for a larger customer, but on a per-unit basis, it's much lower cost. Just so no one's confused that for some reason, you know, the big facilities they see going into an ethanol plant are no more costly than what goes into a homeowner's facility. It's not the case, but on a per-unit basis, it's much cheaper. One other point I wanted to make on the rate freeze that we talked about. In a lot of those cases, rate freeze may have applied to electric, may have applied to natural gas as well in these other states. In a lot of those cases, those rate freezes were made at levels below the actual cost of service at the time because of certain flowbacks that were being achieved through the deregulation process, if I recall correctly. But the one, I think the one leavening factor here, one really not need to be all that concerned about a three-year moratorium, is that the bulk of the cost of service is flowing through the PGA. We do not have frozen gas costs. And so when you see anywhere from 65 to 80% of the cost of service flowing monthly through that PGA, it doesn't leave a lot of volatility in the remaining cost of service items. And as Mr. Towers pointed out, there's that force majeure clause that would take care of anything that would be dramatic, but it would have to be a very dramatic change and the non-gas cost to really lead to what I would call a catastrophic situation 3 or even 5 years from now. So I think I would agree with Keith. If he could have got a longer moratorium, I think that would have been wonderful too. Thank you.
Other questions?
I guess I'd just like to put out one more piece of information. If you compare, we benchmark a 150-therm bill internally when we send the PGA in every month. We put on there the price for 150 therms. If we compare December of 06 was $1.20, December of 07 with the rate increase is $1.13. So even though the distribution delivery rates went up, the overall price is lower. And you can say we got lucky. You can say if gas was $10, it would have been a different story. But the gas supply group works hard to lock in the gas price, and you know, whether it's benefit of the market or the benefit of the supply group, I guess you can argue that, but the fact is, it's, even with a rate increase, the price is actually lower this year than a year ago.
And that information sort of begs the question, and if you're not a gas supply expert or a forecaster and don't feel comfortable venturing a guess, just tell me. But, I mean, what are the folks in your shop projecting out in the intermediate term for gas prices?
As far as this winter, you know, we should be right around that $1.13. You know, I don't think we're going to exceed $1.20 because we've got about 75 to 80% of our gas locked in for this winter. So whatever the market does, it does, but most of our supply is locked in. The prices should be fairly stable for this winter.
Well, and I guess I was interested more on the macro scale, intermediate, you know, 3 to 5 year terms, more global issues, and if you're not comfortable, you know, addressing that, that's fine.
Yeah, no, I...
And the number you would make up would probably be just about as accurate as the one I would make up.
Right.
A lot of volatility in that market.
There's no buy, no gain by giving you a number for me, so I'm going to leave it alone.
Fair enough. Other questions? Anything else? Any comments by Mr. Smith, Ms. Wiest, Mr. Rizlov for our consideration? Okay. Final comments by the applicant or staff? All right. Well, with that, action or discussion is appropriate. And nobody likes to make these motions, so I'll be happy to make it. I would move the commission grant the joint motion for approval of the settlement stipulation. Motion's been made. No second is required. Is there any discussion on the motion?
Thank you for all your hard work.
Yeah, Commissioner Hansen mentioned that earlier, and I'm glad you reminded us all, Commissioner Colbeck. But this is, you start to get a feel just looking through the docket page and looking at all the testimony and trying to get an idea of what did it take to actually put that testimony and those exhibits together. And, commissioners will never really know the effort that goes in. Even if we think we do, we're wrong. And, we discuss this in, an hour or maybe a little more. And I suspect hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of hours have gone into preparing this little hour discussion that we just had. So I think that's a good point. Thanks to the real efforts for everybody. And this process doesn't always end up in an end product that I think is this fair to those involved.
Mr. Chairman, I reiterate what you have to say. When I was, I perhaps have a smidgen more experience in rate increases. As a utilities commissioner for the city of Sioux Falls on water, sanitary sewer, and electric utility, we reviewed our rates, and I was instrumental in doing that on the front line every year and tried to look at all of our capital costs along with operating costs. And it is quite a challenge from that standpoint, just with one community, more or less a wide region to look at. And very, very much appreciate the fact that I did not have to get down in the trenches and go through it on this particular one, because there is a tremendous amount of work involved, and congratulate everyone who was involved in that. Thank you very much for taking that off of our shoulders. And we do have to rely upon folks, and I'm very glad that we have folks that we are confident in that we can rely upon for this. Thank you.
Well, Commissioner, I didn't mean to insinuate that you didn't have that experience, just that it is a little different system-wide, and clearly you know a heck of a lot more than I do, so that'll win you a $5 bet with me almost any day of the week. So, other comments on the pending motion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Colbeck.
Aye.
Hansen.
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. And
thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioners Hansen, Colbeck.
Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Well, I can't say that I'm excited that the last action taken during the Commissioner Johnson reign was a rate increase. But,
you're fired.
With that, we will move to our final item. It's on the main agenda. It is leadership. It calls for the election of a chairperson and a vice chairman of the commission. The first item before the first question we'll take up will be who shall the commission appoint as or elect as chairman for the 2008 year. And we're open for action and our discussion. And with that, I would be happy to move that Chairman Hansen, Commissioner Hansen, serve as chairman. This is not going to be a real risky scenario for the commission. This is not a wet behind the ears greenhorn. Obviously, Commissioner Hansen, he's chaired this commission before, and he has managed large cities. He's managed private businesses. This is a gentleman who certainly knows how to manage. He knows how to analyze. He knows how to make good decisions. And I think particularly in the last couple of decades has shown a real knack for finding the public interest and trying to make sure that he's telling me to stop, that he's getting embarrassed, but his wife might be listening, so she never hears anything good about him. But he obviously cares, and the commission will do very well under his leadership. And that motion has been made. We'll actually see if there's a second. We'll deviate from our standard operating procedure.
Having learned a tremendous amount from Chairman Johnson, I look forward to the next year or two for learning even more from Commissioner Hansen. So I will second that motion.
You undercut your integrity with the group by saying that you learned a lot from me. So calls into question the validity of the rest of your remarks. Motion has been made and seconded. We'll proceed to vote.
Almost.
Oh, we have discussion on the motion. Sure.
It's very disconcerting to have such kind words come from my fellow commissioners, but especially since I wasn't prepared to say anything nice about you. However, I'll wait until after the vote is taken to see whether or not I am compelled to say anything.
Fair enough. With that, if there are no further comments, we'll proceed to vote. Kolbeck.
Aye. Aye.
Hansen.
Aye.
John Swontz, aye. Motion carries 3-0. With that, the invisible gavel of power will be handed over to Chairman Hansen, and I'll relinquish the control of the meeting.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. I was going to call you chairman. I'll be accustomed to doing that, as will I be saying 208 when it's 209 in just a month. I would like to say thank you very much, Commissioner Johnson and Commissioner Kolbeck, and to the staff of the PUC. I appreciated the opportunity that I had as chair at one time. I've been looking forward to doing it again, and I very much appreciate Commissioner Johnson's work as chairman. I in fact learned something from him, and appreciate all of the shouldering of the extra burden and the additional workload that you did. I appreciate your professionalism with the smidgen of levity that you added to it throughout the processes. And I guess I would simply ask that everyone not judge me against the sparkling personality of former Chairman Johnson. And I'd like to thank both for Commissioner Kolbeck and Commissioner Johnson for ignoring staff's requests and voting for me anyway. Is there a motion for vice chair?
Yes, as I mentioned before, Commissioner Johnson does a fantastic job being a PUC commissioner, something that I very much admire and something that is very much a challenge, and every day that we sit on the commission to set a very high standard and set very high level or bar of intelligence that he brings to the job. So I would like to nominate Commissioner Dusty Johnson for vice chair.
I will second that motion on the grounds that I think that the new chairman needs as much assistance and advice as he can, and there's no one better than Commissioner Johnson to give.
I forgot to mention that I really like to be just the commissioner.
You'll never be just a commissioner. Is there any further discussion on the motion? Hearing none, I assume we're ready to vote. Commissioner Kolbeck?
Aye.
Commissioner Johnson?
Aye.
Commissioner Hansen votes aye. The motion carries. Congratulations. And I believe without any further... We'll touch on announcements. Next regularly scheduled commission meeting will be held January 15. Commission meetings are scheduled for January 29 and 12. PUC offices will be closed Tuesday, December 25th in the observance of Christmas. PUC offices will be closed Tuesday, January 1 in the observance of New Year's, and that will conclude this meeting.